rethinking decriminalization.
We had to have a hard wake-up call, but it has not worked here, and it's objectively not worked.
The failure of Oregon's progressive drug policy and what BC is learning from it.
Outrage over Alan Schoenborn's name change.
Because it's not acceptable to British Columbians that someone could avoid public accountability for criminal conduct.
A look at the legislation that allows him to do it.
And a new wrinkle in the Surrey policing dispute.
There's a much more important public safety issue here for the residents of Surrey.
A leaked letter laying out why Surrey RCMP and SPS can't coexist.
You're watching Global BC. This is Global News Hour at 6.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We start tonight with a major shift in drug policy that could influence decriminalization here in BC as well. Oregon rolling back its groundbreaking law.
After 3 years of climbing overdoses and fewer people than expected entering treatment, Oregon lawmakers have a warning for us, too. Paul Johnson has more in the first part of his two-part series on Oregon's decriminalization experience.
I am 26. I've been out here on the streets since I was 13 years old.
Near downtown Portland, we met Sparkles, a young fentanyl user who theoretically could have used Oregon's hard drug decrim model to get treatment. She hadn't, and wasn't sure if it had made much difference to those struggling the most with addiction.
No, but I bet you it saved a lot more lives.
Everyone hoped Oregon's historic Measure 110 would save lives, but the data so far doesn't appear to support that. In the years since Oregonians voted to decriminalize, number of opioid overdose deaths continued to climb every year. That, plus the chaos associated with open drug use, triggered another historic event. This spring, lawmakers in Salem voted to reverse it. Starting in September, it'll be against the law again to use hard drugs in Oregon.
It has not worked here, and it's objectively not worked.
Ben West is a commissioner in Clackamas County and a registered nurse. While his suburban Portland community is mostly liberal, the public outcry against decrim was widespread.
People weren't getting care. They were just getting a $100 ticket and allowed to be in this like dysfunctional hamster wheel of drug use, Narcan, until we don't find you again and we find you dead on the street.
So almost everyone we spoke with agrees. People struggling with addiction ought to be handled by the medical system, not the criminal justice system. But people opposed to decrim here think it happened prematurely, before adequate treatment programs were available and without an effective means of getting people into them.
We didn't get the infrastructure ready in time before we decriminalized, so there wasn't the treatment available.
Maxine Dexter is a medical doctor and state rep for deeply progressive Portland. She's one of the lawmakers that voted to end decrim, which in its 3 years only saw about 1,000 people ever call the state's hotline to get treatment. Ben West says the number of those who actually got into treatment was probably in the dozens. He offers this advice for BC as it grapples with a similar challenge.
It didn't work here, and we've had to make a 180. And don't follow our bad example.
In Portland, Paul Johnson, Global News.
All right, Keith Baldry joins us with a little bit more on this. Keith, that all sounds very familiar. A lot of the feedback is the same that we hear here. So how's the premier reacting to Oregon's advice?
Yeah, Premier David Eby has a news event pretty well every day or every second day. And no matter what the topic is, today it was short-term rentals, inevitably reporters' questions get around to decrim on a daily basis. Police chiefs speaking out, hospital nurses speaking out. Again today, David Eby responding to some of the criticisms and say they're going to ensure that the concerns of police and the hospital staff are going to be met as further changes are going to be made to the decrim program. Here's the Premier this morning.
We'll ensure that police have the tools that they need to make sure that public spaces are safe, that hospitals are safe, that community spaces are safe. And we're engaged with key stakeholders to make sure that that happens, because that's the minimum and very reasonable expectation of all British Columbians, myself included.
So nevertheless, every time I talk to NDB cabinet ministers, I detect a real shift in tone and enthusiasm for decrim. I think there's a number of people around the cabinet table and the NDP caucus who probably now think with an election looming, now is the time to either ease out of the program or end it entirely. Premier David Eby, of course, last year referred to it deliberately as an experiment. Well, experiments end over time, and perhaps the end is near for the decrim. So far, they're sticking to their guns, but with election looming, I think there's going to be some pressure that wasn't felt before.
We're going to find out very soon. Keith, thanks very much.
All right.
We'll call it a war of leaked letters. We are getting a look tonight inside the messy transition of policing in Surrey. It all started with a leaked letter from the RCMP's top brass to Solicitor General Mike Farnworth. And in just the last hour or so, two more leaked letters have surfaced. Jordan Armstrong joins us live to break it all down for us. What's going on, Jordan?
Well, Sophie, just when you thought it couldn't get any messier, a letter dated last Friday surfaces from RCMP Commissioner Mike Duhaime. He takes direct aim at Farnworth's recent claim of an agreement in principle to transition from the RCMP to the Surrey Police Service. Duhaime writes, federal legislation and governor-in-council agreements for provincial and municipal police services do not provide authority to require, on a non-voluntary basis, RCMP members to work under the command of another police service. So essentially, you have the top Mountie saying the BC government doesn't have the plan in place it says it does to make this transition happen. Again, that letter was dated Friday. Then a second letter is leaked to us, dated yesterday from the Deputy Minister of Public Safety to the BC government, and it says something very different. Quote, I am pleased that our officials have been able to determine the approach for transition that can respect existing provincial and federal legislative frameworks. And just after that, a third letter from the federal minister himself saying pretty much the same thing. Of course, the BC opposition jumping on this is evidence they say that the province's transition plan is chaotic with issues unresolved or being resolved at the last second.
The entire chaos and mishandling of this transition is just bad from a political optics point of view. But there's a much more important public safety issue here for the residents of Surrey who are wondering what the heck is going on with this chaotic transition plan.
Now, we are hearing that the two sides have met several times in the last week, including today, and it is now the BC government's belief that there is a path forward with Ottawa. We expect an announcement next week detailing that plan. Sophie?
Can't wait. Thanks for that, Jordan.
All right, connected to the drug trade is our prison system, and being a prison guard can be a very dangerous job. BC's corrections officers are now protesting the fact it's become even more violent with new threats. Kristen Robinson reports.
Fed up with what they claim is a lack of action from Ottawa, the people tasked with policing prisons are taking a stand.
Correction officers are serious, and we're not going to take a shitty contract. We're here to fight.
With contract negotiations ongoing, the union representing some 7,500 federal correctional officers, including 1,250 in BC, says its members are increasingly being attacked.
Numbers have over doubled in the last 5 years of assaults on correctional officers, and yet the service does nothing.
It's a tough, tough career.
In January, Abbotsford Hospital was locked down after multiple stabbings injured at least five inmates at two Fraser Valley prisons, including Matsqui Institution, where Rick Gooman works.
What's your greatest fear?
Greatest fear is death. Inmates have access to a lot of different things with technology.
The union says regular drone drops are delivering weapons and drugs to prisons.
The weapons are getting scarier, they're getting sharper, they're getting bigger, and the inmates have no consequences.
Guards dealing with regular overdoses say the prison needle exchange program sends the wrong message.
Zero tolerance for drugs is what they say in the institutions. Yet we give them a needle to do drugs that there's zero tolerance for.
Some inmates come in with no addictions, and then they leave with addictions.
We asked the Correctional Service of Canada what direct action it is taking to address the union's concerns. No one was made available for an on-camera interview. In a statement, the CSC says these issues have its ongoing attention, vigilance, and action, and it has developed a multi-prong approach to mitigate the risks of contraband.
If you stop the drones from dropping the drugs and the weapons and all that kind of stuff, the cell phones, you stop the black market on the inside of the institutions and you stop the violence.
Kristen Robinson, Global News.
More fallout today from news that child killer Alan Schoenborn has changed his name. Global News has applied to have that new name made public.
Romina Dea has more, including what happened when other notorious criminals decided to take on a new identity.
Convicted child killer Alan Schoenborn has applied to the BC Review Board for a publication ban on his new name.
I think it is absolutely outrageous that someone who has murdered children wants to be able to change their name, and that the public doesn't know about it, that it is done on the sly.
Schoenborn stabbed and smothered his three young children in Merritt 16 years ago. He was found not criminally responsible due to mental disorder. As a patient at the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital in Coquitlam, he is able to leave unescorted for up to 28 days, but he is fearful he will be recognized. Notorious convicted killers from across Canada have tried to escape their horrendous histories.
You have anything to say to us?
Carla Hamolka, Vince Lee, and Kelly Ellard all have new names, but all are in the public realm.
A name change isn't the right to cover up what you've done.
Under the BC Name Act, any adult, even killers, can change their name, and the public has the right to apply for release of the new identity, but it's not guaranteed.
The registrar must give you the new name unless the registrar can show that it's in the public interest not to release the name.
Global News opposed Schoenborn's application for a pub ban on his new name. The BC Review Board ruled in our favor, but there is another step, a pending judicial review. So for now, Schoenborn's new identity is protected.
Under the old law, Schoenborn would have had to take out an ad in the newspaper notifying the public of his new name. But that changed in 2002 under the former Liberal government.
Given these revelations from the Schoenborn hearing, we'll be looking at reestablishing that, because it's not acceptable to British Columbians that someone could avoid public accountability for criminal conduct by simply changing their name.
Romina Dea, Global News.
Police in Saanich are investigating a significant art theft. Take a look. These are some of the First Nations pieces stolen from a home in the Gordon Head neighborhood on April 2nd. The collection included several works by Calvin Moorburg, as well as an Inuit carving estimated to be more than 60 years old. The total value is said to be more than $60,000. The theft happened in the late afternoon or early evening, shortly after the residents had left the home. Police suspect the stolen art could end up being sold online in places such as Facebook Marketplace.
BC's new rules cracking down on short-term rentals go into effect May 1st. The government says those rules are already, or at least the threat of those rules, are already limiting speculation and helping ease the housing crisis. But as Richard Zussman reports, some in BC's valuable tourism sector still have concerns, and they're warning about other consequences of the regulations.
At Airbnb, you can find holiday...
It's a warning to owners and operators of short-term housing rentals. You break the new rules, you're going to pay.
I can't wait for May 1st for these rules to take effect and ensure that homes are available.
Starting May 1st, enforcement will be in place to crack down on illegal STRs. BC residents will only be able to rent out a primary residence or a secondary suite. Anything beyond that could lead to a fine, including a fine between $500 and $5,000 per day per infraction. For corporations like Vrbo and Airbnb, that fine goes up to $10,000 per day.
Up to $10,000 a day per listing is a significant fine, and we believe that's enough of a deterrent.
The new rules will require eligible hosts to display a valid business license on rental postings. Rental platforms will be required to share data, and local governments can request posts to be removed when a business license is not available. The province also launching a website to answer questions for those worried about the new rules.
A group of nearly 300 British Columbians are taking both the province and the City of Victoria to court over the legislative changes. Premier David Eby says he is confident the government will win.
There is a government overreach here. They are canceling existing contracts between businesses and guests and tourists that are coming to the city. They are stomping out mom and pop entrepreneurs.
The group asking for the enforcement to be delayed until the courts can decide.
They are going to have massive unintended consequences, including the movie industry, for example, which is going to have a really tough time trying to manage without having any access.
While the opposition has concerns, it's not the same for many municipalities, with previously exempt areas opting in for the rules, including Tofino, Pemberton, and Bowen Island. Richard Grossman, Global News, Victoria.
Well, the province's new housing legislation could lead to some major changes in two of Vancouver's most affluent neighborhoods. One of the key imperatives of Bill 44 is increased urban density, allowing for the construction of up to four units on a standard residential lot. Vancouver City staff say while much of the city already complies with those new rules, zoning regulations will need to be updated for nearly 600 lots in Shaughnessy and more than 1,100 lots in Kitsilano.
The city is on the province's so-called naughty list, and the province has the ability to force things on the city if they don't improve their regulation behavior and get more homes built. So I hope this is a negotiation between the city and the province, and maybe the province is communicating to council, if you don't act, we're going to act on your behalf. I hope that's what's happening.
A city staff report on the potential zoning changes is expected to be presented to council in June.
Canucks in action tonight, but we are just days away from puck drop on the 2024 run for the Stanley Cup. And not only are Canuck fans elated, but local businesses are celebrating too.
Yeah, Travis Prasad joins us now with more on the potential economic payoff of the playoffs. Travis.
Yeah, Sophie, 4 years since the Canucks have been in the NHL playoffs, 9 years since they've hosted a playoff game in Vancouver. There's pent-up excitement about playoff hockey in the city, and yeah, that excitement is going to spill over into bars and restaurants. They will definitely be busy, and we're now getting a better sense of what the playoffs could mean for the industry. Debit and credit processing firm Moneris will be tracking transactions during the playoffs in Vancouver. In previous NHL postseasons in other Canadian cities, Moneris saw spending increase by more than 230% at bars and restaurants close to the home team's arena. They say spending is strongest close to where the teams play, but restaurants all across Canadian cities and the surrounding areas get a boost in business during the playoffs. But sales patterns show it's not enough to just make the postseason. Moneris says it's clear that teams have to win for their fan bases to spend their hard-earned money. The company points to an interesting trend they saw in Toronto last year when the Leafs were in the second round of the playoffs.
They had an away game and they won. And around the arena, we saw 120% increase in spend in the restaurant industry. But in game five, that was actually a home game, they lost, and we only saw a 7% increase. So actually winning has more of an effect on what, on the increase of sales than whether you're at home or away.
People want to be with people to support their team. And why not just be a great host to people, make it affordable when they come, have some fun, and celebrate with people when the Canucks score and they do get a victory that night. That's so key.
No, it's no secret. Times have been tough lately. The cost of everything seemingly on the rise, and that means less disposable income. So for some people who don't have the money for a bar or restaurant right now but still want to watch the Canucks playoff games with their fellow fans, we're still waiting on word of whether there'll be any public watch parties in Vancouver. The city telling us they're still in talks with the Canucks about that. We know Surrey will not be hosting any public watch parties, but we just got word that the city of Delta will be. They'll be hosting those at the Social Heart Plaza, and that's near the North Delta Rec Center. Sophie, Chris.
Looks like a lot of room behind you where people could assemble for a watch party, Travis.
Absolutely.
We'll see what happens. Thank you.
Tim Hortons customers feeling double-crossed by the company. Many received emails laying out the prizes they had thought they won in the Roll Up the Rim promotion, including a valuable boat worth thousands of dollars. But they quickly found out they were losers, not winners. That's next on the NewsHour.
Somehow he's survived, and he's kind of thriving, really.
Still to come tonight, how Stanley Park's artist-in-residence has made a life for himself and the support network who have his back. Plus,
this is the ice from the Sedins' final game. They gave 4,000 to season ticket holders.
The Canucks collection you have to see to believe, and the diehard fan behind it coming up as well.
First, though, there are a lot of disappointed Tim Hortons customers tonight who thought they had won big on the coffee chain's Roll Up the Rim to Win promotion.
Yeah, Tim's blames human error, but that is not much comfort to those who had their hopes raised. Consumer Matters' Andrew is here with more on the fallout. Ann?
Thanks, Chris. Outrage is a bit of an understatement for impacted Tim Hortons customers. Some say they are now seeking legal advice after the coffee chain blamed the false winnings on what it's calling a human error. It's unclear how many customers have been impacted, but what is certain, this is a mistake many customers won't soon forget.
As I look here, congratulations on winning 2024 Tracker Targa. Vote.
It was a Tim Hortons email that left Justin Russell filled with excitement. A recap for the Roll Up to Win promotion, informing him he had won a boat valued at around $55,000.
So I thought, summer's coming, wow, we got a nice boat.
To be certain, Justin walked to his local Tim Hortons to ask an employee if the email was the real deal.
Said, yes, you won. They were all excited for me.
But the celebration ended an hour later when Justin says a customer service rep confirmed he didn't win the boat and a technical glitch was to blame.
My legs almost sunk to the ground right in the store.
He's not alone. On Wednesday, many Tim Hortons customers across the country expressed anger after receiving a similar recap email stating they too had won prizes, including the boat, only to receive another message from the coffee chain stating technical errors may have resulted in incorrect information about roles or prizes. Tim Hortons telling Consumer Matters in part, unfortunately, there was a human error that resulted in some guests receiving some incorrect information in their recap message.
I don't accept that at all. It's not the first time that Roll Up's done this.
It's true. Just last March, Tim Hortons had a similar mishap after a glitch unintentionally told consumers they had won a $10,000 prize. Some marketing experts say those types of mistakes could erode the brand's value.
Its whole positioning as the local friendly Canadian brand could be significantly damaged.
Already hundreds have turned to social media platforms expressing their frustration and in some cases perhaps pursuing legal action. Justin Russell, also feeling the disappointment, hoping Tim Hortons offers some compensation other than just an apology.
I think somebody should be held accountable. I don't think this is fair.
Now, Consumer Matters reached out to Tim Hortons more than once, asking about compensation for affected customers. And we also asked what steps it's taking to prevent this from happening in the future. But we never received a response to those questions. And if you have a consumer issue for me, you can email me at consumermatters@globalnews.ca.
All right. Thank you, Anne. The Cambie Street Bridge will be shut down overnight for a major movie shoot. It's not clear what's being filmed, but the third installment in the series Tron shut down the bridge last month. Filming will take place tonight between 7 p.m. and 6 a.m. Buses are being rerouted and drivers, pedestrians and cyclists are being told to take another route. Those at home could also be affected. City of Vancouver warning residents might notice some noise and lights from cranes used during filming.
Coming up, the effort to calm a stranded orca calf.
It's a teachable moment for all of us.
First Nations hoping to help prepare the young killer whale for a new rescue attempt. Plus,
most of them end up with varying degrees of PTSD.
From lab to love, why these beagles are experiencing freedom for the first time. Well, there's a flurry of activity in Zabelas today as crews prepare for the second time to rescue a stranded orca. The first attempt was nearly a week ago.
Cassidy Moscone is in Zabelas tonight. Cassidy, officials won't say exactly when round two will begin, but it appears likely to happen soon.
There really were some sure signs that things are starting to happen up here in Zabelos. The team is assembling. We've seen a number of different agencies roll through here today, bringing with them a lot of different equipment, like you can see behind me. Large boats with netting has arrived on Hadasat land. Officials locked off the boat ramp to the public today as they prepared, and while Chief Simon John went out on the water with the DFO for a welfare check on young Quisa Hayes, who was very active in the lagoon where she's been stuck for 26 days now. Also on scene today, the neighbouring Hamalco First Nation and Cape Mudge First Nation, as well as Vancouver Aquarium Marine Mammal Rescue staff. We also had the incredible opportunity to speak with Victoria from Hadasat First Nation. She was out with a number of young community members late yesterday, connecting with the whale out on the water through song.
It's a teachable moment for all of us, for all humans, I think, right? But yeah, for all of our people, and we haven't had this before in living memory. We know that they're considered our ancestors, and feels like a duty to share song.
Bring some comfort to the whale.
Oh, yeah. We hope that's what our hope is. We're sharing something from our hearts.
Both the DFO and Hadasat First Nation are keeping the timing of this rescue mission on lock. I really wish I could provide you an update on when it will take place. All we know is that timeline is getting closer.
Thank you very much, Cassidy.
An animal rights activist group says Canada needs to do more to protect animals being used for testing. That's after a number of dogs were rescued from American research laboratories. The group, the Beagle Alliance, says 10 dogs were rescued from U.S. labs, and it's fostering 5 in Alberta and 5 in B.C. It says the Beagles range in age from 3 to 7 years old and have spent their entire lives in a lab.
Over 90%, probably over 95%, are Beagles, and that's a global statistic. Docile, forgiving, easily fit in a cage so they can test on more of them. For the most part, Beagles are used in biomedical research, so it could be inhalants, it could be injections. So most of them end up with varying degrees of PTSD and anxiety.
The group says most animals used for research in Canada are euthanized after studies are done. It's advocating for stricter laws that would require that they be found homes.
Still ahead, surviving in Stanley Park for 34 years.
And you go down to the beach, build a fire and roast it.
How Chris Bailey gets by with a little help from his friends.
Also coming up, $1 million basement shrine to the Vancouver Canucks and the super fan who owns it.
For 34 years, Chris Bailey has secretly made his home deep in the forest of Stanley Park. But even while living in a handmade shelter with little or no income, he's been able to survive and live life on his own terms.
Alyssa Thibault joins us now with part 2 of Chris's story. Alyssa, 3 decades is a very long time, especially when you're in the woods. How has his life changed over the years?
Well, so the first 2 decades, Chris Bailey was living a very humble existence, surviving off only the bare necessities. Just a few years ago, things changed. Chris experienced some health challenges, which sparked a series of events that changed his life for the better. Tonight, we take a closer look at how he lived so long in the elements.
Through 30 years of rain, snow and summer heat, Stanley Park's longest resident has been living outside and content.
You know, you can get 4 or 5 weeks in a row without sun. And I'm perfectly comfortable. I have no time schedule usually except my own.
Somehow he's survived and he's kind of thriving, really.
From his campsite in the forest, Chris Bailey ventures out often by bike.
So these are just inner tubes.
His ride rigged up to support anything he might need to carry.
When it gets loaded up, like for groceries, there's, I'd estimate, like 200 pounds on the bike before I get on.
These days, he buys his food. But in the early years, Chris would feed himself by dumpster diving or catching wild geese and ducks.
It was easy to do. Get some grain, go down to the water, throw it at the grain in the water, they show up, you bag one, pluck it. And you go down to the beach, build a fire and roast it.
Determined to be self-sufficient, he often refused offers of food vouchers and clothing.
He never took anything from us. I think at one point I got him a pair of shoes just because his were so wet, and he was so grateful and so thankful.
With a talent for painting, Chris worked sign-writing jobs around the city, and he stayed connected with technology by travelling to UBC and spending up to 20 hours a week in the computer library.
The patterns of living and subsiding were basically by what I was able to think up. One of the happiest periods of my life was that period decade forward. My income at that time was less than $300 per year, per annum, for that 10-year period forward. See, I love this part.
Life here is centered around the forest. Tell me what you like about this particular tree.
Looking at it from here, I think that's an incredible look at it.
Plants and animals all playing a role in Chris's journey through art and self-development.
You're in this place. There's no involvement. You're not studying a book that says, do this for tone and shade, or any teacher, instructor. It's between you and the natural world.
In 2017, everything changed.
As a result, I think, of some of the nutrition deficiencies and a contact with contaminated water, that resulted in some skin conditions.
Chris started becoming sick. He travelled over the Lionsgate Bridge and received help from a clinic on the North Shore. With no ID, he was then referred to the Canadian Mental Health Association and paired with a caseworker named Jeff.
He arranged for legal forms for me to sign, which swore that I was the person that I said I was.
Chris was set up with a bank account and a pension, suddenly making $600 a month.
And you'd never had that much money before.
Yeah, I was flabbergasted, right?
He could buy himself a phone and start an Instagram account for his art. But his skin condition required surgery after doctors discovered a benign tumour. A $1,000 hospital bill came across the desk of his caseworker.
But when it was apparent that there was something that it might not be covered, Jeff said he would pay for it, you know.
Wow. Wow.
He was that kind of guy. Yeah, he would great. All right.
Is that making you a bit emotional, thinking about that?
Thinking back, yeah. Let me drink some water here.
Yeah.
Seeing him almost cry made me cry.
Jeff Bodnarik now lives in the interior. He worked with Chris for 2 years.
I enjoyed talking to him and listening to some of his stories and how he grew up. I remember him bringing out his sketchbook and being very proud of his sketchbook.
It was his job to find out who Chris was.
And just remember trying to get those breadcrumbs on where he was born.
Through his connections, Jeff was the one who managed to get Chris a bank account, even without identification.
You know, I figured the guy was eligible for sainthood myself, you know, with what he had accomplished. And
by this point, Chris had spent 27 years living alone in Stanley Park.
Did you have any discussions about trying to get him out of the park?
No, because that's not what he wanted.
In 2019, Chris was preparing to leave, but Jeff had left his role and the process of getting Chris a passport stalled. His case fell through the cracks.
How much longer do you think you'll be staying here?
I don't know. It's up in the air.
His time in Stanley Park is coming to an end, but what's next is unknown.
A lot of great feedback about these stories. Tomorrow you have more, too, Alyssa, on the next phase of life for Chris.
Yeah, we've certainly had a lot of interest in Chris's art, and he is making some decisions about what happens now with his work. And tomorrow we take a look at what's next for Chris. Now, we know his time in Stanley Park is coming to an end, so we look at what options he could be considering. And after spending 3 decades in the park, how has he seen it change? The sights, the sounds, what is different? And you can read more details about tonight's piece online. The story is now available on our website, and you can also see some extended video there. Chris and Sophie.
All right, look forward to the next phase. Thanks very much, Alyssa.
Well, there are Canucks fans, and then there's Dave Stein.
Vancouver Canucks versus Los Angeles Kings, 1970, $6.50.
His incredible collection of memorabilia and the one item he wants more than anything. Lots of beautiful blue sky out there today. Here's Christy with a look at the weather forecast.
Well, the forecast is pretty simple over the next 24 hours, you two. Blue sky is expected right through our day on Friday. Nice way to finish off a work week, that's for sure. It's really important, though, to remember tonight it's going to be cold. We have a couple people out in the Fraser Valley that were saying to me last night, oh my gosh, it was down to the freezing mark. My plants are having a hard time. So anywhere away from the water, yes, you could see pockets that are close to the freezing mark. So make sure you're prepared for or preparing any plants that can't handle that, bringing them in indoors, for example. So cold at night, but then rebounding during the day. A lot of areas seeing a fluctuation of 15, 20 degrees. So look at these temperatures, 17 in through Lytton, 19 out through Hope and through the Fraser Valley. So terrific conditions for our Friday. Enjoy it because we have this next system that's going to move across quickly on Saturday and into Sunday, but it looks like the majority of the moisture will happen overnight Saturday, which is good news, but that's certainly going to bring in more cloud cover Saturday and Sunday in cooler conditions. So tomorrow's certainly the bright one, that's for sure, and nice and mild. We're looking at near seasonal values in the interior and above seasonal values across coastal regions. So we're talking about 16 to 19 degrees for Metro Vancouver. As I mentioned, yes, we're expecting some rainfall Saturday, more likely late in the day, and then we'll see that rainfall overnight for the most part into Sunday morning. But it's not a washout over the weekend, that's for sure. But certainly make sure you enjoy or make use of tomorrow if you can. Tonight's Central Windows weather window coming to you from Clinton, where Amanda Nelson captured this shot where, yes, there's an odd one in the group here as they're flying back north. Can you see the one there?
Mm-hmm. Snow goose? Is that Canadian a snow goose geese in there?
Yes, exactly. So just hitching a ride. She has captured this. Hitching a ride or, yeah, lost his crew. I'm not sure.
That's funny.
Getting a little pull from the rest of the gang there.
That's right.
All right. Squire is here. What else are we going to talk about, Squire?
Well, from here on out until the Canucks are no longer in the playoffs, it's Canucks. And they will only have a couple of days to get ready for Nashville. Game one will be Sunday, but Rick Tocchet says it's not a problem.
Usually you adjust after game one anyways. They know us. We know them.
Canucks beat the Preds three times this season, but that was early in the year. After the All-Star break, Nashville was much, much better.
Well, I'm not going to change the topic because also tonight...
So my collection's worth at least $1 million for everything that I have in this basement as of now.
The Canucks super fan behind this mind-blowing collection. Everybody's talking about the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Well, we are in action tonight.
This is actually the last night of the regular season. Mm-hmm. The only thing left to figure out is who the Kings and Vegas are going to play. Anyway, we know the Canucks are going to play Nashville, and game one will be Sunday night at 7. Game two will be also at Rogers Arena next Tuesday. The Canucks are finishing off the regular season in Winnipeg, and the main piece of advice the coaches gave the players on both these teams tonight is don't get hurt. In this game, the NHL should stand for No Hit League. Connor Garland's out there. J.T. Miller has the night off. Brock Besser not playing. Ian Cole, Philip Roenick. First goal was kind of just having Connor Garland go to the net, and a clearance went right off of him and in. So it's 1-0 for Vancouver. Jets are sitting some main guys as well. Shifley, Connor. Gabe Vilardi's out there. Makes a move on Thatcher Demko and scores to tie it 1-1. Demko wanted to get in this one to get him one more regular season game before the playoffs begin on Sunday. Early in the second period, 3-on-1, Cole Perfetti, 2-1. Now, of course, the Canucks want Elias Lindholm to come to life offensively in the postseason. He gets a goal here on the power play, deflecting in the Quinn Hughes shot. Hughes did not get tonight off. He wanted to play. So after two, it's 2-2. Before the game, the Canucks gave Vasily Podkolzin a new 2-year contract. He'll get a raise, not very much, but he is going to make $1 million per season for the next 2 years. Only has played, 18 games for Vancouver, full games this year, has no goals. But he has been pretty physical, and even though he's not playing like a 10th overall draft pick and his stats may never equal that lofty a draft position, the Canucks have worked with him, especially the Sedins, to get him to play a role that makes him a more effective bottom six forward, who could develop a bit of a scoring touch. After all, he had 14 goals in his rookie year for Vancouver 2 seasons ago, but right now he's concentrating on doing what is asked of him.
It really comes to guys who are banged up, guys who need it. That's really what it comes down to. You look at some other teams, they played their full lineup. So it really...
Okay, it happened again to us. Anyway, yeah, very strange. After last night's game in Arizona, the Coyote players and staff took a photo on the ice because this was the final game after 28 years in the Phoenix area. It became official today. Next year, the Coyotes will play in Salt Lake City, and they'll be called the Utah, insert name here.
Oh,
well, they'll have
a
name, I'm sure. But right now, it's insert name here.
What do you? How do you design a logo for that?
We're gonna have to talk about that.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's at least one Coyote in the state of Utah, so you don't really have to change the name. They didn't change the Jazz name, the basketball team, when it moved from New Orleans to Utah. Yeah. Utah's not exactly known for its jazz music, so why not stay with the Coyotes?
We'll see what happens. Thanks, Squire.
And sticking with the Canucks theme, up next, the superfan hoping to add the ultimate collectible to his shrine.
This is BC with Jay Durant, is brought to you by JM Media.
Jordan Armstrong joins us now with a preview of what's coming up on Global News at 11 tonight. Jordan?
Chris, Vancouver police are putting out a warning about a high-risk sex offender who will be living in the city. Police say 61-year-old Scott McKay poses a significant risk to women in the community, including sex workers. He is currently on day parole, serving a life sentence for second-degree murder, sexual assault, and forcible confinement for the 1987 killing of UVic student Marguerite Telsford. Her body was never recovered. McKay is also a person of interest in another unsolved homicide. As you can imagine, there's a lot of reaction to his release, and we'll have that plus the conditions he's under at 11. Chris?
All right. Thanks very much for that, Jordan.
Well, Vancouver Canucks fans are about to get their first taste of playoff hockey in a long time. And for one super fan, supporting the team extends far beyond just watching the games.
That's right. As Jay Durant shows us in This Is BC, over the past 25 years, he's invested countless hours and hundreds of thousands of dollars putting together the comprehensive collection of Canucks memorabilia.
This is my custom-made Vancouver Canucks versus Montreal Canadiens bubble hockey table.
And the game is underway.
It was 30 years ago this spring when the seeds for a superfan were planted.
Begging my parents to let me stay up late so I could watch those games that were going past, you know, my bedtime.
Robin's got Adams. Adams shoots, scores! Leading to a massive collection that started with a gift from his parents.
So the first piece would be a signed Stan Smith puck.
For the past 25 years, Dave Stein has been collecting Canucks memorabilia.
I'm probably on the internet every single day, you know, looking to see what's out there on auctions, Marketplace, Craigslist, different type of silent auctions. Vancouver Canucks versus Los Angeles Kings, first ever game, 1970, $6.50. I got a Pavel Bure signed photo. This is a game stick. These are the signed jerseys from Daniel and Henrik Sedin after they got their 1,000 points.
Now showcasing over 1,000 certified autographed items.
So this is my prized possession. This is the Roberto Luongo 2010 game-worn jersey. There's red inside the arms, and that's the sweat bleeding out into the jersey. And I really thought I was just going to have a few pieces, and then over time, it just happened to blow up. Then every few months, I try and find another piece to buy.
No luck with the search for a Canucks pinball machine, but he did buy one that plays arena rock.
Most recently, my basement was appraised at just over $1 million for everything here. And if people think I'm super crazy, so be it. I put my money into this. You know, I work very hard for what I have. I don't have much space anymore.
But Stein will definitely move a few things around to find room for one more that everyone's been waiting for.
I would like a picture of the team holding the Stanley Cup. That's all I want. Doesn't even need to be signed. I have the perfect spot for it. Something will go off the wall, and that'll go right on the wall, and that'll end the perfect collection.
Jay Durant, Global News.
Jay is exactly right. We all want that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you know someone who has a great story to tell, email your ideas to Jay. thisisbc@globalnews.ca.
And what are we thinking? Sunday is the start of playoffs, mm-hmm. Squire?
Sunday will be the start, yep. And then Tuesday, and then they go back to Nashville.
All right, let's hope it happens this year.
Well, right. I mean, I think they should win this series.
Yeah, let's... Hey.
That's my thinking.
Right? Let's have reasonable expectations.
Once four wins at a time.
Stranger things have happened. Last word on weather before we go, Christy.
A fantastic day for a Friday. Couldn't have been any more beautiful than that, with highs of 19 degrees away from the water.
All right. I hope your week is coming to a glorious end with a forecast like that. Thanks for watching, everybody. Have a great night.
Good night, all.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.